Excuse me, the recordings have now started.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bennett.
Could we have a roll call, please?
Yes, certainly, Michele. Good morning, good afternoon, everybody. We have on the call today Michele Nilon, who is the chair of the IRTP group. Kevin Erdmann from IPC, Barry Cobb from the business constituency, George Anil George from the IPC, and Chris Chapler from the business constituency. And for staff, we have Marika Koenig and Glenda Sanchez. Thank you. Michele, over to you.
All right, thank you. Good afternoon, or I would say good morning and good evening and whatever. How are we all this afternoon?
Fine, thank you.
Okay, in terms of turnout today, I gather from the conversation we were having before that we started recording this that there's a clash with a couple of meetings at the moment, which is why our turnout is so bad. Marika, which meeting is this clashing with today?
This is Marika. There is a meeting, let me just check the official name of that, of the High Security TLD Program Advisory Group. And I've already spoken with the person responsible for organizing that meeting and asked him if, going forward, if he can please avoid this slot and any other GNSO working groups that have members in common. So I've already shared with him the details of those days and times that we normally have our calls. So hopefully this it will only be today, that clash.
Right. So I think that's a short-term group as well, isn't it? I mean, it was just, if I'm not mistaken,
no.
It was something that was called together for just a couple of meetings or something?
Well, I think that they need to deliver something by Nairobi, but what I understood from Craig is that they do have quite some work that they need to do. So they are looking at bi-weekly, if not weekly, calls as well of that group. But I think they are going to discuss that actually at today's meeting and determine what is required and when and how often they should meet.
Okay, fair enough. Perfect. I see Paul Diaz connecting as well just now.
Yes. Thank you.
Good
sorry I'm late.
Yes. You're forgiven. Just don't do it again. or we'll make you stand in the corner. We have apologies from Matt Serlin, Mikey O'Connor, James Bladell, and one other person.
Barbara Steele,
thank you.
Yes.
Okay. Marika, would you just let us know when, as soon as you get a chance anyway, if there's going to be problems with this time slot in terms of clashes? If we need to look at rescheduling or whatever, then obviously we'd prefer to do that sooner rather than later.
Yes, and I apologize for not being aware of this conflict. I only realized as well when Mikey actually sent the email of his apologies to this group, but which I think I saw this morning, and immediately after that I contacted my colleague who was responsible for organizing the other meeting and strongly advising him next time to check in with us just to make sure that there are no conflicts, as there are a number of members that we have in common with this group and as well with other GNSO working groups.
Well, it's not your fault, it's his fault. I blame your colleague. Because we were here first. Anyway, okay, moving on, and now that we've finished bitching and moaning about other people. Right, we've had a The agenda we have today is to continue looking at the public comment period, grid, and the constituency/stakeholder statement stuff. Does anybody have any other matters that they wish to raise at this time before we plow into that?
This is Marika. One other thing would be to look at the schedule going forward. I mean, we can do that on a point four, confirm the next meeting, but just so we make sure that we confirm a date for after the holidays, as I presume, based on our normal schedule, we wouldn't be meeting next week. And I presume people don't want to meet between Christmas and New Year's either.
Well, if people want to meet between Christmas and New Year's, they may do so, but I won't be involved. I'm not going to be available. Okay, looking at a post-Christmas, what date would it be? The 5th, I think, of January is the next Tuesday after Christmas, unless I'm mistaken.
Correct.
That's right.
Unless anybody has any reason not to, I would suggest that we look at having the next meeting on the 5th of January. Because obviously we're not going to have one on the 29th.
Chris here. Michele, the only thing is we've got them already booked in a two-week cycle. I suppose it's not critical, is it? But it just
makes it
a little bit easier.
Well, the only problem is if we skip... we can't go for the 29th, because let's be realistic, most people are going to be doing the family thing. And even if we don't have families, we'll have hired one just for the interim. The next one after that then would be the... if we skip the 5th, then we don't have anything again until the 12th.
And this is Rickard, and another issue that we might want to discuss, I don't know, now or maybe in the beginning of January, I mean, if we want to have some kind of draft document or some kind of initial status update by Nairobi, you know, we might want to consider at some point as well switching to weekly meetings in order to get some more stuff done. I mean, some of the other working groups are now coming to closure, like SCI efforts and things like that, so the question would be as well whether people have the time to maybe at some point consider switching to weekly calls.
Mm.
Are people going to think on that over the holidays as well, if they want to? I don't need an answer on that now.
Okay, well, I mean, just something which is worth considering. What do people feel about moving towards having weekly meetings?
I'm personally okay, Chris speaking.
Okay.
I'm fine with it, Barry.
Okay.
Same with Paul, no problem.
Okay. One of the things that Marika and I were discussing, I think it was yesterday. Sorry, I've lost all track of time, so I don't know whether it's day or night half the time. It was yesterday I was talking to you, Marika, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right.
Thank you, Marika. One of the things that we were discussing yesterday was looking at timelines in terms of actually producing something tangible out of this process, so that your Tuesday afternoons aren't a total waste of time. The GNSO Council meeting schedule, I think through till after Nairobi, has been posted already, with the deadlines for documents and everything else. So if we want to get something into, even if it's just a kind of a rough draft or whatever, we need to kind of meet certain deadlines in order for that to be feasible. So where was the deadline thing there? What were the dates on that again, Marika? You might have them to hand.
I don't have them at hand, but I think...
I look at that, Michele. Give me 2 minutes.
It's okay. I have them here. I can probably pull them up. I'm on my slower desktop machine here. Where the hell has it gone to?
Just on a general note, if we want to have a community discussion in Nairobi, I think the deadline is 15 working days beforehand. The document needs to be, or ideally, needs to be available for people to review. But that's specifically looking at Nairobi.
Okay, for Nairobi, we'd need to have something in by about the 15th of February, from what I'm seeing here. So I've got three dates on this spreadsheet.
That's right. Absolutely.
I don't know what those three dates refer to, but I presume there's something to do with the Nairobi meeting. 6th, 7th, and 10th March. What happened to the 8th and 9th? Glenn?
The 6th and 7th are the days on which we have our working sessions, the GNSO working sessions.
Is that the weekend? The weekend before
that's
the
weekend, and the 10th will be the day of the council meeting.
Okay, so basically, all right, okay, so that's specific to the GNSO meetings. Yes, that's much clearer, sorry. Okay, thank you. Yes.
And basically the date for all that stays the 15th of February.
Okay, perfect. Right, so... Would it be reasonable to expect us to have something to work with in Nairobi? or are we being unreasonable in aiming for that?
And this is Rita. If I could just add something on, you know, having something for Nairobi could be as well just you know, an outline of the discussions we've had and possibly some ideas or suggestions that we've discussed on each of these questions to maybe have a broader discussion with the community. I mean, that could be instead of having maybe a finalized initial report, and take that out to public comment at the same time, it might be something more of a first draft of that initial report. So there already can be some discussions if people feel that might be useful for the further deliberations of the group.
Okay. Anybody else?
Yeah, Chris speaking. I think it would be desirable for us to table something, wouldn't it?
Well, I mean, the thing from my perspective is if we don't start looking at putting some kind of deadlines, this is just going to go on forever.
That's right. And also, if we're on a two-week schedule, we've only got, after today, then three meetings before the 15th of February.
Well, I think we need to revise the two-week meeting concept anyway. After Christmas, maybe if we discuss that after Christmas, rather than trying to make a decision today.
Okay.
But I think we do need to look at that. I mean, take as a kind of a takeaway from this is to consider, okay, after Christmas, can we move towards having weekly meetings or something along those lines? Somebody else mentioned on a different working group yesterday the idea of trying to proactively discuss topics via the mailing lists. The problem with that, I think, is that quite a few of us have other... what's that word I'm looking for? Hold on, it begins with an R. Oh, yeah, responsibilities. So that might not work too well. Any thoughts, people? No? Okay. Well, maybe we can just kind of follow this up towards the end. Right. So, Marika, could you continue with the grid, please?
Yes, of course, Michaela. We left it last time at issue C, whether some special provisions are needed for a change of registrar when it occurs near the time of a change of registrar. The policy doesn't currently deal with the change of registrar, which often figures in hijacking. And a comment made there was that any kind of changes, such as registrant change, should be followed by a cooling-off period, which should be no longer than 10 days.
Okay. Any comments on that?
Michaela, it's Paul.
Yeah.
Or Marika, I don't recall the exact post, but any sense where they came up with a number like 10 days? Why 10 as opposed to 30, 45, 60? I mean, just it seems like a number picked out of thin air.
I don't know. I would need to look back to the original comments. I can just speculate that maybe the current practice where some have 60 days was considered too long and maybe 10 days was seen as more reasonable. But, again, I'm just speculating here.
Yeah, that's all I'm asking for, too. It's just, you know, it seems one extreme versus another.
Okay. I mean, just realistically, when it comes to timelines, what do people think are good times to look at? I mean, is 10 too short, too long? What are people's thoughts on it? In general, I'm not saying specifically in relation to this particular comment, just in general terms.
I'll offer Michaela, it's Paul again. I would think 10 is on the short side. Just because, you know, if you mean 10 calendar days, what does that mean for business days? Getting in touch with people, if there's something that needs to be resolved, sorted out, a 10-day period, especially if it's calendar days, starts the clock ticking, it can be difficult getting in touch with someone whose information is not accurate. I mean, we all can imagine. I don't necessarily have an opinion, you know, how much time is needed. But 10 seems short, and considering all things in the ICANN realm, the amount of time given, the only thing that's less than 10 days would be a grace period. But typically, you have much longer time frames to work in.
Okay, now can I be a nasty swine? not that whether you say yes or no is going to make any difference to what I'm going to say anyway.
Chairman's prerogative.
Oh, totally. Let's say, for example, in the one of the things that has come up time and time again is in relation to hijacking of domains. So if, for example, I were to hijack networksolutions.com, which I know you'd say is impossible, but if I were to somehow manage to hijack networksolutions.com, would you be willing for me to retain possession of that domain name for longer than 10 days?
No, of course, I'm following you, but let's think about this particular issue, the questions put forward to us in our charter question. If special provisions are needed for a change of registrant, okay, when it occurs near the time of a change of registrar, okay, so at this point we've not seen a hijacking take place.
Okay.
The charter question is asking us, all right, you have gotten into an account, you've changed registrant information to some email that you can control, and then initiate a transfer request. And this very often sets off red flags because it's suspicious.
Okay.
And it could factor into a hijacking attempt. So it hasn't happened yet. The question becomes, should registrars for security purposes have the ability to freeze that account for a set period to make sure that it's not some mischievous activity?
Okay.
Right? The question is, you know, how long, what is reasonable to freeze the account? If it's a legitimate circumstance, the counter-argument that's often given is that, hey, it's somebody who had not really focused on their account. It's come very close to renewal time. They realize they need to take advantage, and they want to switch to a different registrar, and all these things happen. I know I can speak for Network Solutions. We have a process where even if we've frozen the account, the registrant can call into customer service, providing a couple of pieces of information, demonstrating they are who they really say they are. They can get that lock removed, and the transfer will be allowed to move forward. That's how we do it. It's not how everybody does it. And that could be in less than 10 days. So if it's a legitimate case, the person calls, they demonstrate their bona fides, and everybody's happy. In the event that it's some mischief, somebody's gotten into account, changed the admin because they were intending to try and hijack and whatnot, yes, sometimes you have a very dedicated social engineering crook that may try, but for the most part, that security measure, that lock, will protect the legitimate registrant who is probably totally unaware of the attempt on his domain.
Marika?
Yes, doesn't work. I just looked back at the original comment, and basically the person said that I would, however, prefer to see lower delays than 30 days. I think that 1 week or up to 10 days would be better. So that's why his reason for stating 7 or 10 days, basically.
Does anybody else have any thoughts on this? I mean, okay, I know it's a bit... I mean, the other thing as well... Okay, actually, I'll rephrase this. The first thing is, I'll pick on Paul. Paul, does Network Solutions track the number of, how can I phrase this, the number of potential incidents that your internal policy may have avoided?
I will say probably. The data is not available publicly. Let's put it that way.
I mean, the thing is this. As things stand at the moment, there seems to be an issue with, there's a perceived issue with some policies that registrars have put in place in order to protect registrants. The problem is that we don't seem to have a huge amount of data on this. As in, it's kind of like, you might say, well, this is preventing something, but the counter argument is that somebody's saying, well, you're holding on to my domain for 10 days. I mean, is that policy of yours, is it clearly stated on your website, or how does somebody find out about it? I mean, how is that communicated?
The details of what we do, because of what we're trying to do, it's a security measure. It's not spelled out in great detail. Customer service is there 24/7, toll-free, email-based, you know, however folks need to prefer to get in touch. And the process will be explained to them at that time so that, again, for legitimate people, they can work through it. Data that I've seen, internal data, and I'm sorry, it's proprietary. We won't go into any detail publicly on how many cases, but the mechanism we have in place, which has been refined repeatedly over time, has been quite effective in protecting legitimate folks. And again, our policies are such that for those who do have a need, it may have tripped the flag and we put the freeze, but they can legitimately demonstrate they are who they say they are and have the right to the registration. They can have that lock undone and move their name out. And again, all that will be explained by customer service, and often it can be affected in very short order.
Okay. Anybody have any other thoughts or comments?
This is Barry. I guess I just have a quick question, trying to really understand the issue C question in general. Let's put aside all of the possibilities for abuse that we're trying to correct here. I guess my question is, you know, how often would a legitimate person out there be making an update to their registrant, or that there is a change of registrant within a short time frame, that all of a sudden they're going to change a registrar as well? Or can somebody give me a real world example of what's going on here?
Yeah, was that Barry?
Yes, this is Barry. I'm sorry. Thank you.
Barry, no problem. It's Paul again. My example that I offered is actually quite common, that the true registrant, it's the domain name is coming up for renewal. And, you know, sort of at the 11th hour, they realize, whoops, I have to renew. They go into the account, and they want to make changes. And they also want to change to transfer the name to a new registrar. And they're trying to do this right at the end, just before the renewal deadline takes place. What you'll often find is that a name might have originally been in the name of you know, somebody in the technical side of the organization, and they now want to change it to, you know, somebody else. Again, we can work with them and get that work that out when it's legit. But there are plenty of people that are tracking valuable names that see opportunities like this, and will try to game the system, take advantage and steal the name away.
Okay, good. Thank you. Yeah, I do appreciate I'm going to call it a best practice from your guys' perspective, that there is this manual method that I can turn off the locks and still complete my transaction. I guess the only thing that, you know, that I'm starting to see out in the community is, you know, that there's these communications out to the registrants that, you know, is asking you to update and verify your who is. And if that does happen to fall right about the time that I am going to renew my domain, then it's, you know, then it be kind of, it comes as somewhat of a, I guess kind of say forced, if you will, that I need to go update my changes. And typically when I do it, I'll go through. And for the sake of being comprehensive, like when I add new domains to my account, there might need to be a change in like my 866 phone number, or you know, some people will choose, instead of using their actual name, they'll put domain admin instead of their actual name to try to use a hint of privacy, if you will. I guess that kind of forces the lock without them knowing it, but I would certainly agree that if there is any kind of policy set forth here, then we would definitely want to associate the best practice of allowing some sort of manual way to unlock it for the legitimate aspect. Thank you.
Anil?
Thank you. I was just thinking, I'm not sure what the correct number of days would be, but it sounds like in some instances, as Paul was saying, they were able to take care of it in a relatively quick manner. But I guess we have to think about registrars that are not able to do that or may not have processes in place. So we probably have to consider all sorts of entities that are a mixed bag. And for them, in bad situations, 10 days may not be enough. And if maybe it has something to do with allowing them to lock it for a period and then remove it when it's understood that the right registrant is going to be or registrar is going to maintain the.
Okay. I see somebody else there in the queue. Was it Chris, I think it was, and then Paul.
Hello there, yes. Yeah, for the unlocking, obviously it's easier for a registrar to satisfy themselves or come up with some the necessary documentation that they need to satisfy themselves. It gets more complicated for us in actually defining a policy, doesn't it? But actually what I wanted to just ask or think about is, in the legitimate buying process, I'm assuming that in most cases we're looking at the change of a registrar. Now, is it normally done that the change of registrant is done before the change of registrar, or vice versa?
Do you mean in terms of an auction process, or what?
Well, it might be an auction process, or it might be just two parties deciding to sell a domain from one to another.
Okay.
So having agreed the deal, as it were, the next step has either got to be change of registrant or change of registrar. Which comes first? Which would normally come first?
Either.
And is that a balanced either, or is it normally one way or the other, or is it?
I can only speak from my own personal experience. I've seen some places where they do, but where it's one. I've seen others where it's the other, and others where you can choose. I don't know if anybody else wants to make any comments on that. Anybody else? Has anybody else bought any domains on the aftermarket or sold them?
Well, our experience is registrars, this is Paul again, network solution experience, is what you described, Michele, that unfortunately it's not predominantly one or the other. It's a mixed bag of both.
And I can see reasons why it's good that it's fluid, personally, as a buyer. Chris?
Yeah, as a buyer, I mean, I haven't bought many, but I would think I would prefer to change registrar first and get the domain into my account and then try and change the registrant details. That's just my feeling.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, I mean, okay. From my perspective, as both a registrant and a registrar, no offense to Paul, but if I pick up a domain that happens to be registered with Network Solutions, I'm hardly going to leave it there unless I have to. I'm obviously going to move it to my own accreditation. Paul, anyway, you were next in the queue.
Sure. And just to follow on, I totally agree with you, Michele. I mean, we do the same. We have clients that simply want to consolidate portfolios. It's understood. I mean, that's why we have a free market like this, that people can move to the registrar of their choice. I think you have to remember, of course, that in the case of a domain name transaction, whether it's a sale or an auction, what have you, you know, unless you have a lot of confidence in a lot of faith in the person that you've acquired the name from, getting the name in your under your control to begin with, to change the registrant contact information, will probably precede a change of registrar. Otherwise, you're dependent on that selling party to move the name to the registrar of your choice for you. And if people have put up a lot of money, they're probably not going to be willing to do that. They want to have control. But again, there are various examples. The only reason I raised my hand, I wanted to go back to Anil's point when we were talking about timelines and whatnot. Please also understand, one of the reasons I think 10 days is probably too short is that, like we have to do in the case of a breach, if we get notified of bad who is contact information, registrars, sometimes even in our own records, the only thing we have to go on, emails bounce, phones aren't answered, so we have to send snail mail to the registrar, asking them to correct. The same sort of thing might occur here, that in the case of a change, if we try and reach out to the registrar, we can't get through to them. The only thing we may have on file is a mailing address, and if you have to use the Postal Service, in particular if that individual lives in a country other than the country of origin for the registrar, 10 days is simply not going to be enough time. Get the letter out there, get them to respond, send it back in. So it's just a thought again for whatever the time frame here is. 10 may be too little. You know, the higher end we can debate as part of the working group.
Okay. Any other thoughts on that? Hello? You've all gone very, very quiet. I know that Paul is a very good interlocutor, but seriously, guys, come on. Don't be afraid to query him. No? Okay. In terms of developing policy then, do we think that at this juncture, those of us who are on this call, do we think that something needs to be put in there about changes of registrant data prior to a transfer? Does something need to be in the policy, or is the current policy okay as it is? Hello?
I have my hand up.
Oh, sorry. It's gone terribly quiet. Go ahead, Marika.
I mean, I don't have a view or opinion on the question you just asked, whether that should be a specific change in the policy. But I was just wondering as well, as we've been talking as well, and alternative answer to this question might relate to the means and speed by which legitimate registrants can unlock domains after they've been locked in these kind of instances. So I wonder as well if this question could possibly be addressed as part of questions D and E that relate to best practices around registrar lock. Just an idea.
Okay. Okay then. Anybody have? Oh my God! All the hands went up. I'll take Paul then. I'll take Anil and then Paul. Sorry, Anil, please.
I would think because we've been charged with really examining this issue of hijacking, this is a problem that occurs in real life. It seems that it occurs because perhaps certain procedures are not in place or could be in place. I mean, I guess we can debate what those procedures should be, but it sounds like we should think about what would be ways or procedures that could hopefully minimize the occurrence of this event. And the fact that it's occurring would suggest that we need to look at procedures as an important part of that process.
Okay. Paul?
Yeah, I completely support what Neil just said. Anything we do here, let's always remember to address one issue, that we don't create loopholes or security concerns. We don't want any unintended consequences coming out of the working group's efforts. Two thoughts here. One, addressing Marika's point about the time frames to unlock. Of course, the existing rules do talk about the mechanism that exists cannot be any more cumbersome. I'm blanking on the exact language, but there is something in the policy already. I question, you know, in cases where registrars are making it very, very difficult to remove a lock, to me that then it becomes a compliance issue. I don't know if we necessarily need to create additional verbiage because there is something in the existing rules. And as far as issues, you know, C, do we need to specifically address registrar? We have something of a chicken and egg issue here, I think, in that one of our charter questions also talks about should admin be raised up to the same level as registrant. And we kind of have to think that through and come to a consensus because if that's the case, then, you know, admin and registrant would have to be specifically cited. If we only cite registrant, then I guess that implies we're going to maintain the status quo vis-a-vis the more important or the highest authority in terms of control over our name. Don't necessarily have a view on that, but I'm just looking at our charter questions, and it seems we can't get to one without first addressing the other.
Okay. Anybody else have any thoughts on this? Tim, you can come out of the corner now. It's okay.
Thanks. Sorry about that.
Just don't do it again. We were very upset. We felt, oh, my God, but GoDaddy have deserted us. What are we going to do? The world is no longer spinning on its axis. My designer informs me that his cat has rebooted his laptop. Okay. Right. I'm just looking at the current policy. Where is it? Where is the section about? Can somebody remember which section it is where you can the reasons for denying transfers? Which section is that again? Applications, evidence of fraud. Oh yeah, denial, evidence of fraud. So would the existing evidence of fraud argument hold true in this at the moment if there's a change of registrant, or does something specific need to be added? Suppose is the question.
I'm sorry, would you say that again, McKelly?
Sorry, no, I'm looking at the existing policy document for the transfer registrations between registrars. Now, without getting into the entire admin versus the admin contact versus the registrant contact, just in terms of reasons for denial of a transfer, there are a specific set of rules there. And as Marika pointed out, there's the entire thing about the lock statuses, which comes into play. Or should we look at the lock statuses first, more directly? Okay, well, okay, we'll move on then. Marika, could you move on to the next bit, please?
Yes. So the next bit is issue D, whether standards or best practices should be implemented regarding use of registrar lock status, given when it may not, should or should not be applied. And the first comment there is that any discussion should be in line with the current protocols as registrar lock was used in RRP, which has been superseded by EPP. And if I could recall well, I think this person provides some more technical details as to why I think the current statuses that are being used are not in line with EPP. But I have to refer that to someone that's more familiar with EPP to probably explain it in further detail.
Okay. Anybody have any thoughts on that? No? Okay. Oh, Tim, sorry. Tim, I didn't see you. Tim, go ahead.
I was a little slow getting my hand up. Yeah, you know, just my thought would be that, you know, while it might be, there might be some things that the group might consider, that what we wouldn't want to do is limit registrar's ability to be innovative. And I think if you look around, especially some of the, at least some of the more well-known registrars, and I'm sure other registrars are doing the same thing, but they, you know, have implemented various security types of services of their own that help to secure and lock down or protect the main names from being hijacked or changed fraudulently or whatever. And I think those have value, and I wouldn't want to take away that ability or the ability of registrars to differentiate themselves. So just kind of throwing those caveats in there as anything's being considered as far as, you know, limitations on how a lock might be used.
Okay. Chris is asking a valid enough question. I can't remember what RRP stands for. Could somebody please tell me what RRP stands for?
I think Registrar Protocol, I think.
Okay. An EPP is Extensible Provisioning Protocol, which is a way of, how can I describe it? It's a way for registrars to communicate with registries. And it's basically sending loads of XML messages backwards and forwards. It's how registrations and updates are handled these days.
Thank you.
And this is Mirjam. Just looking back at the original comment, and he's suggesting that a more appropriate term would be to speak about client transfer prohibited status value.
Okay. So it's the actual value in who is that he's referring to specifically, is it?
If I understand him correctly, I think he's indicated under EPP you can have different statuses that appear in the, like fined, prohibited, and he gives some examples. So I think the point he's trying to make is that we're talking about within that context you can have different kinds of locks that have different purposes and different meanings. So what I think he's trying to say, that register lock seems to imply or tries to imply that there's only one kind of lock. Well, I think the point he's trying to make is that actually under EPP you have different categories that are used in different cases depending on the scenario that is involved. And I hope Paul is going to provide further explanation.
Okay. Paul, would you have you?
I think Marika is absolutely dead on. My guess with this person, if we have the ability to reach back out to them, anybody who's talking about technology and protocols is a well-informed customer and you know, as a member of the group, I'd really like to hear more about what their thinking was. But I think the part of what they're probably saying here is also that stick with the locks that exist in the protocols, not something a particular registrar has made up. They call it their own super-duper lock. And it's not it's unique to that particular registrar. I mean, a criticism we've heard in other working groups is the existence of some registrars having their own internal processes to lock down a name, and there's no way for anybody on the outside to understand, does a lock even exist? Because you don't see it in EPP, you don't see it in the registry's output. It's all internal. It's behind their wall, so to speak. And my guess is that that's part of what they're getting at here. Use only the locks that exist in the protocol, not these internal one-offs.
Okay, very good. I would just speak to that as well. I mean, one of the problems we've seen as a registrar is exactly what Paul has indicated, where the computers in the background that actually handle all this stuff can't see, as it were, that a domain is locked because the registrar hasn't actually used a lock that exists within EPP. So instead of our system rejecting the transfer request within, say, oh, I don't know, say 20 minutes of the registrant ordering it, it can take, I don't know, 24 hours maybe for the system with all the messaging and everything else to come back and say, well, actually, that transfer can't go through. So that is a bit of a problem. So anybody else have any other thoughts on locks in that respect?
Yeah, this is Tim.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I had to leave my computer, so I couldn't raise my hand. Yeah, you know, in regards to that, I think, though, that we want to be, my opinion is it just, we might want to be cautious about trying to formulate policy around that because, you know, we call it a lock, but, I mean, it's really not. I mean, it's just, registrar's internal processes that are, dealing with requests in its own particular way, and it might be that it's denying requests or limiting how certain things can be done by a registrant for who knows what reason. I think the focus should be, and so trying to define what that lock is or how that's going to be applied in policy, you know, would be, I think, next to impossible. So I think instead what we want to do is focus on behaviors and, you know, the behaviors that we need to see or that we want to limit and not so much on, you know, this concept of, you know, a private lock by a registrar because that's all over the map and I think it's going to be hard to even define, let alone try to formulate a policy to limit it.
Okay. I might have to disagree with you, Tim, but that's just me.
You know, because we can call it, what would we call it? We call it a registrar, an internal registrar lock, but maybe I call it something different. And so I just ignore it. It's unenforceable is what I'm concerned about.
Well, the problem I have personally is that if I do a whois lookup on a domain name and I don't see a lock of some description in whois for that domain name, then it looks like it's unlocked and that I, either as the registrant or as the registrar, should be in a position to transfer the domain. So it goes back to a case of transparency.
Yeah, but give you an example. Let's say that, you know, I've had credit issues with a particular customer. And so as far as I'm concerned, if he wants to continue to deal with me, you know, there's certain things I'm going to require. Now, if he wants to go to another registrar and, you know, deal with them and transfer the domain name, you know, we might let that happen. But until he does something like that, you know, if he wants to renew within our system, we might limit his ability to do that. Is that a lock? You know, I don't know. We don't consider it a lock.
We're talking
fraud protection, you know. But that's what I'm talking about is that when you try to define this lock, what you have to focus more on is the behavior and not, trying to define what an internal registrar lock is.
Kevin?
Yeah, your discussion sort of raised a question in my mind along the lines of, you know, what we were discussing in terms of what a lock is supposed to be and supposed to do, because we have, you know, in the UDRP context, the well-defined situation with what happens to the domains while the dispute's in progress until its resolution. And it seems to me that since there's already a process that's analogous to what we're looking at here, that it might make sense to try to, you know, use a similar mechanism, whatever that mechanism is, even if it, you know, it's implemented, you know, a thousand different ways, that we have, you know, like you were saying, the behavior defined of what we want to have happen in this period, regardless of whether we call it a lock or a shutdown or whatever.
Yeah, and this is Tim again. That's all I was saying. I'm not questioning whether there should be some limitations. I'm just saying that as we talk about those, we just want to put them in terms of behavior and not try to define things that I think may be undefinable.
Okay. Kevin, have you got anything further on that, or is your hand just up from before?
Oh, yeah, sorry, I haven't turned it off yet.
That's okay. Marika, do you want to have a look at the next one, please?
Yes, of course. Next comment says that the use of lock status should not be limited, but it should be possible for registrants to change status online.
I don't understand that comment. That's my immediate reaction. What do they? What do you? What does that mean exactly?
My interpretation was that he is of the opinion that a registrant at all times should be able to change the status online, and it should not limit his or her ability to do that.
Oh, okay. So use of status, like I said, should be, not be limited, and it should be possible for registrants to change status online. It's the bottom.
Yeah, he's trying to say, instead of trying to limit registrar's use of the status,
okay.
I think it would be better to make sure that registrants and customers have the possibility to change the status online through their respective registrars.
Okay. No, sorry, it was the bus that confused me, Marika. Any, Paul?
Yeah. Thanks, Marika. And you just added a very important clause that doesn't appear in the spreadsheet now. Change the status through the registrar, correct? We're not talking about opening up the ability for end users to start changing EPP statuses, correct?
Correct.
Okay, because, I mean, there would be one of those enormous unintended consequences. I mean, folks, I don't think we definitely don't want to recommend giving folks the ability to start dealing with registries directly.
This is Barry. I think that's more along the lines of Pandora's box.
Absolutely agree.
I'll add that clarification to the next version.
Okay. Anything further on that one, guys? No? All right. I think we've got time just to have a look at one more before we call this a day. And actually, I think we'll be calling it a year, won't we? Next one there, please, Marika.
Next comment says that each status value can be associated with a message which might be used to provide as an explanation for the basis that enabled this status value. And if I recall well, I think you made the point that as in EPP, you have many different options to have status updates, but it might help to have that information displayed in who is, so registrants or end customers actually know why their domain is being locked. And I think you were making the point as well that it's actually not being used, but that technically it shouldn't be too difficult to link the status to the value or the message.
Tim? Tim?
Yep, sorry, I was talking away on mute. So in EPP, you know, there are various different lock statuses, and they each have a description. So I wonder are they talking about clarifying those or putting an actual reason instead of just a description? I'm just throwing out some questions, I guess, but I just don't completely understand what they're looking for. Or if they may even be aware that EPP already displays a description of the lock. Client renew prohibited, client transfer prohibited. You know, there's each one has a different description. I think it's like four of them or something.
This is Mike. I can just read, you know, the section of the paragraph that he wrote in this. And I would also like to point out that in EPP, each status value can be associated with a message. In any language, as a language tag can be provided alongside the message, explaining the reason of the status. This message is optional and seems to be seldom used, but it could be useful for registrars to provide it, as it would give an explanation for the basis that enabled the status value. And he adds as well, this would enable the registry and or ITEM to immediately assess if the statuses are used for valid purposes and in accordance with the relevant policies if registrars are required to file the message with a valid reason.
Okay, so maybe we could find out if, because what I don't know is, I didn't know that was available, and if it is, then I wonder if we did use it, if it would actually show up in who is. That might be a good question for the registries.
It'll show in who is for a thick registry. I don't think it'll show for a thin one. Let me just check something here. I'm logged into VeriSign at the moment just to see what. what the hell it's doing. No, actually, it does show in the thick one, as, in the thin one as well. It's reflecting the same EPA stages. Because the five statuses available are client transfer prohibited, client hold, client delete prohibited, client renew prohibited, and client update prohibited.
And each of those have an optional field that would display with a, that we could put a reason in or something like that.
I can't see. I'm looking at the VeriSign name store manager, and I don't see any option to do that there. But then again, I think that would be if it's for a thin registry, we as the registrar would probably have to do it. Not too sure about the thin ones. Something worth looking at, anyway. I mean, at least we can actually look at it and be given informed, have an informed opinion on it.
Right, right. Just so that as we discuss it or consider it, we understand what the implementation implications are.
And this is Marika. It might be worth asking Barbara, because I recall in the IRTP Part A working group, we actually had a colleague of hers taking us through EPP, and you know, I think he was involved in developing the protocol for that. So he might be a person that can provide further information as to how this would work and how this would would be implementable at the register level as well.
Well, I'm just being terribly boring and actually just logging into, I've logged into the Filius registrar backend just to just actually see what a thick registry was giving. There's no option for a description beside the status. So I could set the status on a domain, but I don't have any way of adding any extra messages in that I can see. No, there's no option for that. There's no way to add any. There's nothing. All I can do is I can manipulate the basic objects. I've no way of adding in any notes or anything which would appear in Whois. So unless they change something on their end, I can't see how you'd do it. But obviously somebody from the registries might be able to correct us on that. Tim?
Sorry, I'll put it down.
Okay. We've reached the top of the hour. So I think we might want to call it a year. I was going to say call it a day, but as it's, we're not going to be meeting again until the new year. Can we call it a year? Because I'll feel happy. Now, the question we were discussing earlier was in relation to the next meeting. So Chris, based on what Chris was saying, what would the next date be? It would be the... We're skipping the 29th. So the option is to either go with the 5th or the 12th. If we're continuing on our two-week cycle, then the next meeting will be the 12th of January.
Correct.
So is everybody happy with us going for the 12th, or do we want to move for the 5th?
I'm okay with that.
If we really want to get something, ready by Nairobi, I would actually advocate meeting on the 5th.
Okay.
This is Barry. I second that, and as well, especially if we're going to be moving forward with weekly meetings, so then it removes the two-week cycle.
Okay. Does anybody have any objections to moving to a weekly meeting cycle, with the first meeting being the 5th of January 2010?
No.
Okay. Last call for objections. Okay. Working on the basis that you either have no objections or have not voiced them, move to weekly meetings in 2010, with the first one being on the 5th of January, and Marika and her colleagues and staff are going to check to make sure that we don't have too many conflicts with other meetings. So if I don't speak to any of you, have a very nice Christmas, Hanukkah, or whatever it is that you're celebrating, wherever you are, and if you're really boring and not celebrating anything, enjoy doing that too, and I'll speak to you all in 2010.
Yeah. Good one.
Thanks, Keely. Have a good day.
Thanks, McKinley.
Michele, okay, this is Jen.
Yes.
I'll put those on the calendar so that they are there. Everybody can see them.
Perfect.
And if you could also send out a notice to the IITP group when the next meeting is, and with the proposal that we're going to switch to a weekly meeting, so those that are not on the call are aware as well, and can object if they really
I'll do that. It will go out with the MP3 recording.
Great.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Okay, and I'll speak to some of you later this evening, I believe.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye. Bye.